Hello, Kaiju campers, and welcome to Camp Kaiju Monster Movie Talk. I am your host, Vincent, and tonight I am flying solo. It's been a while, and I am excited to see what I got, see if I still got the old mojo. Tonight we'll be talking about Mothra, 1962. There is a slight discrepancy in the dates. We'll get to that in a little bit, but tonight, in addition to the good, the bad, and the downright campy, I am going to dive a little bit more into the production history, sort of the talent behind and in front of the camera, and just to, as we think about the movie and I run down the plot points, think about the social and historical context in which it was made. Because as an artist, you know, I could say that rarely is art, or at least good art's never made in a vacuum, right? The people behind it, they're thinking about the world in which they live. And us today, maybe there's something we can learn from it. I don't know. Maybe it's just a monster movie. Either way, this is what I really love talking about. So thank you for joining Camp Kaiju tonight. Before we get started, I just got to plug the old t-shirts. Link in the bio for that. You can follow and engage with Camp Kaiju on Instagram and Letterboxd. Again, would love to hear from you, your favorite monster movies, correct me on anything I got wrong, or just say hi. I love saying hi. So let's get into it, shall we? So Mothra, 1961. It was released by Toho Studios. It's directed by Ichiro Honda, who of course directed Gojira in 1954, and Rodan in 1956. So he was working with Toho Studios at this time. He had directed some other kaiju movies, like Varin and I think the Mysterians in the late 50s. But in terms of like the classic kaiju that we know and love, still relatively new in the game. So Mothra, you know, it's part of the big five classic Toho kaiju, and it's the third that Honda has tackled himself. So it stars, and forgive me on the Japanese names, but I think I got it. Frankie Sakai as Zenichiro Fukuda. He is our sort of our protagonist. He's the one like we're really supposed to follow through this whole story. He's a journalist. Kyoko Kagawa as Mishi Hanamura. She's his partner. She is a photographer at the newspaper. So they are not lovers. Interesting. I just made that connection. I love it when men and women can just be friends in movies, especially older movies. Then we have Hiroshi Koizumi as Dr. Shinichi Shuzo. And Hiroshi Koizumi, he's like our doctor. He, you know, you gotta have that stock character. And he's the one who's really gonna talk to us about what's going on. He's a linguist, and they bring him along to talk to the Shobijin, the little fairies that Mothra is so well known for. So, and that actor actually, he had just appeared in Godzilla Raids Again, the previous Godzilla film. So already, like, if you're in Japan in the early 1960s, and you're, like, digging this new genre of kaiju movies, you're starting to see, like, is this a universe being created? Because it's not the same, you know, character, but it's the same actor. Now we're all coming together. So, I don't know, very exciting. This actor would go on to appear in tons of Godzilla movies, including Tokyo SOS in 2003. So, well-known face in the franchise. And then, oh, this guy. This is our villain. His name is Jerry Ito, and he plays Clark Nelson. Not a Japanese name, but he is a Japanese man, and he's our villain. And he's like a greedy capitalist businessman who has no qualms, cutting corners, and he comes off as like a real mobster type character, which is a lot of fun, especially if you're into, you know, crime movies, I guess. And then, like I said, the Shobijin are played by Umi Ito and Emi Ito, And they are actually, so they're twin sisters, and they were known as the Peanuts. So they're vocal performers. They weren't actors, but a really popular vocal duo in Japan at the time. And if you know anything about Mothra, there's like a lot of music. Music is so important to Mothra movies, in addition to the Shobijin fairy twins. So Honda and the rest of the crew at Toho were like, we got to get them in the picture because A, they're popular, but B, they're super talented, and it really worked out well. Oh, and then another fun little casting. So Kenji Sahara, the another really well-known actor in Kaiju Godzilla movies at this time. He was in Rodan previously, and he just makes a brief appearance as a helicopter pilot. So look out for Kenji Sahara. It's a good time. And then of course the special effects are by Eiji Tsuburaya. He's back. He and Honda, what a dream pair of filmmakers. And I'm gonna get to his work in the good when I get there. So all this came together based on a 1961 serialized novel, short story called The Luminous Fairies and Mothra. So I was surprised to learn that Mothra was based on a book, which I don't think is the case for other kaiju creatures. Correct me if I'm wrong, please do, but I thought that was interesting. So I've thrown around a bunch of dates. I've said 1962, 1961. Vincent, what year did Mothra come out? Both. So it was released in June 1961 in Japan. And then Toho at the time had a deal with Columbia Pictures in the United States for distribution in America. So it was dubbed over, it was shortened by 10 minutes, and released in May of 1962 in America. And that's the version I watched. That's the one, at least the first version of Mothra you see on Amazon Prime. And I was like, let's watch it. I've never seen Mothra. I would love to see the Japanese cut. And actually, that's, something that didn't quite always jibe was the dubbing. Sometimes it just takes you out of it, and you just wish, I think I'd rather hear the actor's voice themselves, So, be that as it may, I wanted to settle the debate on the year. So yeah, there you go. That is the basic groundwork for Mothra from Toho Studios. And if you've never seen the movie, I'm gonna give a brief synopsis of the film, just so from here on out, you can know what the heck I'm talking about when I say things like Newkirk City or the Shobijin, if you haven't caught on already. And if you have seen Mothra, well, maybe take this time to go get a drink. Who knows? So the movie starts in the waters off of Infant Island, a presumably uninhabited site for Rolisican atomic tests. Time out. First of all, I am reading this via wikizilla.org. In the future, I hope to write my own plot synopses, but in the meantime, this is what we're working with. And I said Rolisican from the fictional country of Rolisica, and that's important to know. It is a fictional country. So, Rolisica. All right, here we go. In the waters off of Infant Island, a presumably uninhabited site for Rolisican atomic tests, the Genyu Maru II is caught and run aground in the turbulence of a typhoon. A rescue party following the storm finds four sailors alive and strangely unafflicted with radiation sickness, which they attribute to the juice provided them by island natives. The story is broken by tenacious reporter Zenichiro, the snapping turtle Fukuda, and photographer Michi Hanamura, who infiltrate the hospital examining the survivors. So these are the journalists and the photographer I was telling you about. The Rolisican Embassy responds by co-sponsoring a joint Japanese-Rolisican scientific expedition to Infant Island, led by Rolisican businessman Clark Nelson. Okay, so maybe he's not Japanese, but he sure ain't American. He's Rolisikin. Also on the expedition are radiation specialist Dr. Harada, linguist Shinichi Chutsu, and stowaway reporter Fukuda. Yeah, so that's what happens. Our bumbling reporter Fukuda stows away on board the ship. There, the team discover a vast jungle of mutated flora, a fleetingly glimpsed native tribe, and minuscule twin girls. These Shobijin, as Fukuda calls them, wish their island to be spared further atomic testing. Acknowledging this message, the team returns and conceals these events from the public. Nelson, however, returns to the island with a crew of henchmen and abducts the girls, gunning down several natives who try to save them, while Nelson profits off a secret fairy show in Tokyo featuring the girls singing. Both they and the island natives beseech their goddess Mothra, a giant egg, for help. Fukuda, Hanamura, and Chutsu speak with the girls, who have learned Japanese through their telepathic ability. They express conviction that Mothra will come to their aid. Meanwhile, Fukuda's newspaper has accused Nelson of holding the girls against their will. Nelson denies the charge and threatens to file a libel suit against the paper. Meanwhile, the egg on Infant Island hatches to reveal a gigantic caterpillar, which begins swimming across the Pacific Ocean toward Japan. The caterpillar destroys a cruise ship and survives a napalm attack on a beeline path for Tokyo. The Rolisikin embassy, however, defends Nelson's property rights over the girls, ignoring any connection to the monster. Yeah, so a lot of stuff happens in the middle of this movie. Our villain has kidnapped these fairies. He's holding them against their will. He's put them in like a vaudeville show. It's very King Kong, and the public's loving it. But our trio of good heroes are like, yo, you can't do that. You need to let them go because their giant goddess moth caterpillar is coming to Tokyo to destroy us all. And the capitalist showman, of course, is like, nah, that ain't true. So, finally, Mothra arrives on the Japanese mainland, impervious to the barrage of weaponry directed at her, ultimately building a cocoon in the ruins of the Tokyo Tower. Public feeling turns against Nelson, and he is ordered to release the girls. He flees incognito to Rolisica, where Mothra, now in her imago stage, the flying stage, immediately resumes her search. Police scour Rolisican capital Newkirk City for Nelson as Mothra lays waste to the metropolis. Ultimately, Nelson is killed in a shootout with police, and the girls are assigned to Chutsu's care. Observing a religious significance in Mothra's unique symbol, which resembles the Christian cross, Chutsu hits upon a novel idea to attract Mothra to an airport runway. And there he kind of like paints this giant cross-like image. So Mothra sees it, she lands, the girls are returned amid salutations of sayonara, and Mothra flies back to Infant Island. So in a nutshell, in a cocoon, that is Mothra. A lot of strange words, new vocab in there. And I'm going to get to the bat a little bit later on, but if you're kind of like, what the heck? What? I'm with you, totally. So thanks for your patience. We'll get back to my script. So like I said in the beginning, artists, good art is never created in a vacuum. And you know, just doing a little bit of digging into Japanese history at this time in the 50s and the 60s, which I'll tell you, I didn't know, but I wanted to bring that to this show. It makes a lot of sense, the themes I'm seeing in Mothra. You know, it's critiques on capitalism. It's critiques on atomic testing. And I'm going to get to like three main points that's going to like go, oh, okay, I know what Ishiro Honda was going for. So right off the bat, in the beginning, we see a Japanese fishing vessel like run into trouble with radiation. And that is straight out of the Lucky Dragon 5 incident that happened in 1954. And if you're familiar with kaiju or like Godzilla movies, you've probably heard that name. So it's actually an event that directly inspired Gojira in 1954. Basically, there was a tuna fishing crew in the South Pacific, and they were Japanese, and they were caught in the fallout of a hydrogen bomb test near Bikini Atoll. And all the crew members came down with acute radiation sickness. One of them died, and he is considered the first victim of the hydrogen bomb. So not only is Japan reeling from the atomic bombs at the end of World War II, but now they're caught in the Cold War nuclear race between, you know, America and Russia. Russia, America, Rusilica. So that's where that name comes from. When you're watching it, it's a not so subtle dig at these two superpowers. And at the time, Japan, so US occupation of Japan ended in 1952. By 1961, there was a peace treaty or a security treaty that America and Japan had signed, right? And still in place today, or some version of it, where the United States is pledged to defend Japan should it be attacked. And that's why Japan doesn't have a standing military of its own. It's us. So in 1961, this was still very new. And the Japanese government, the Japanese people didn't quite know what to do with this. True, America was no longer an occupying force in the country, but Cold War politics, we were still pulling strings behind the scenes. And in 1960, this security treaty was up for renegotiation. And actually, it was a stronger security treaty that had been in place before. So on paper, it looked great for Japan. Like, America's pledged defense and now has to consult our government. So we get, you know, so Japan gets a little bit of a win in this security treaty. However, since it was up for renegotiation, everyone but the prime minister was like, well, then do we have to do it? Like, what if we just stay neutral? Because guess what? We don't actually want anything to do with this Cold War. We don't want to be caught between the United States and Russia, who is actually just across the sea from us. Like, they're super close. It actually led to a lot of riots called the Anpo Riots in 1960. Massive demonstrations, and one university student was killed in that. Again, I'm talking like an expert. I literally just looked this up, but it's fascinating history, especially when you consider it was happening the summer before Mothra was released in Japan. And actually, the novel that Mothra was based on really leans into those politics and is really critical of this tug of war that Japan was caught in. So, super fascinating. Called the Anpo Riots of 1960, or, you know, just do some quick research. Fascinating stuff. So, with that said, now we have Ishiro Honda, who we know loves contemporary criticism. You see it all over. I mean, Gojira is a masterpiece in all of that. You see it in Rodan. You see it... the themes he establishes, you know, his critiques of crash commercialism and capitalism and using humor to do that, you know, you definitely see that come into play with Mothra versus Godzilla and then King Kong versus Godzilla. So knowing that the standalone Mothra is the first, like, kind of sandbox where Honda gets to play in those with those artistic licenses is really fun to watch. And that's, I don't know. I liked Mothra a lot just as a standalone monster movie, but knowing the history now, I can appreciate it on a deeper level. So yeah, that's pretty cool. Your head's probably spinning, but thank you for sticking with me. okay, so Rolissica is a stand-in for Russia and America, and then the capital of Rolissica, Man, could they have picked a tougher name? is a city called Newkirk City. It is sort of an amalgamation of New York and San Francisco. It's clearly a Western style city. And actually, a bit of trivia, in their deal with Columbia Studios to distribute it in the United States, apparently Toho had to feature an American location. So, they did it. They made it up. I don't know. Maybe they could have just said, this is San Francisco. I don't know what would have been strong. I do know what would have been stronger, and I'm going to get to it in a second. Okay, so here's what you've all been waiting for: the good, the bad, and the downright campy, as I saw it in Mothra. So with the good, Honda is at the peak of his game here. He's fully aware of the social context in which he's living. Again, those critiques of capitalism that will appear again in future Honda films. Like in those future films, the cast in Mothra is having a ball. Like they're really fun to watch. They're having fun with each other. The chemistry is tight. The humor is good-natured. And honestly, I have to give shout-outs to Frankie Sakai as our hero bumbling reporter and Jerry Ito as the villain. 'Cause like, man, there's no doubt that he's a bad guy. He's got this great, like, melodramatic, sinister voice, and he like curls his eyebrows and his lips. It's good stuff. The story is good. It takes a little bit of time to get, the kaiju action, but like a lot of movies of this time and Honda's movies, if you just treat it as a good drama, comedic drama that it is, it holds up. The score itself, like the actual score, doesn't really stand out, but those musical numbers do. Like I said, there's a lot of great dance scenes, some fun choreography. You see the Shobijin, they are in a not in a theater, Broadway style theater, performing a show. There's a lot of razzmatazz. I don't know. It's fun. It's good stuff. And it's all aided by the special effects of Tsuburaya. His model work in this, Mothra may not be the best kaiju movie from this time, but I think it contains some of the best model work that I've seen from kaiju movies at this time. And it's like the scale is perfect. There's a great sense of scale. When Mothra is attacking and when the caterpillar Mothra is attacking, like it's clearly model work, but it's so good and very detailed, to be more specific. And then what Tsuburaya does with Skull, or not Skull Island, Infant Island is reminiscent of Skull Island in that it is an unknown land of peril and mystery. It's dark and foreboding. There are vampire plants that attack one of our characters. I'm like, I want to see more of this island, please, in future Godzilla movies. We don't really, and that's a shame. But for this movie, yeah, it stands out. Oh, and of course the design of Mothra looks scruffy. It looks like she's an actual giant moth. And the caterpillar version, I've never seen it look so, as I put it, perfectly imperfect. It's discolored, it's lumpy and warty. It looks great. It looks monstrous. I mean, later versions of Mothra seem to be really pretty in a polished sense, but no, scruffy's the word in this one. And it's she really bears the presence of destruction super well. So the bad then, let me go back to Infant Island. So there are natives, of course, which are great. You love a well-populated island of sinister natives, But they're all done up in a sort of blackface. At least they are covered in black makeup, or like, I don't know. It was weird in like, a slightly racist way, and you're just like, just kind of takes you out of it a little bit. The whole Rasilica thing just struck me as odd in terms of geography. And here, and I've thought about it, and here's what I've come to. So in these kaiju movies from the Showa era, there's a lot of made up places, which is what you love, the imagination, the fantasy, right? But these places are always other planets, or they're under the ground, or they're underwater. So you do have a sense of geography, even though they're made up places. But with Rasilica, it's supposedly in our world. It's just like another city, but it's another country. And our characters are able to drive there from Japan. And I was just watching it and I was like, wait a minute, wait a minute, wait a minute. We just drove from Tokyo to Newkirk City. But I'm looking at a map right now, and last time I checked, Japan was an island. So I think it's fair for criticism because it made me confused in the moment of like, what's the layout of this world? I don't understand. If you want to make up a city, a Gotham or a metropolis, fine, but don't have your characters just drive there from an island, or your Mothra goes off and attacks it, which is great. You love to see it, but I didn't quite know where we were when. So that was my biggest criticism. And then just something else. I was hoping you all could help me out with this. I was a little confused by the ending and the invocation of the religious symbolism. Because 99% of movies that I watch that invoke religious symbolism do so as a critique on religion. In this instance, it struck me as the opposite. Like they have used church bells and the image of the cross to attract Mothra and save the day. Which is fine if it's not a criticism. Like, that's totally fine. It just played against my expectations. And maybe that's just me, but for me, that clash against expectations just had me. Because I know Honda is so intentional about everything. So I was like, then I don't know what your intent here is. Unless it's just to say that Mothra is a deity. And a good-natured one at that, then yes, you did it. But yeah, I don't know. I don't know if you all, what you all think about that. I would love to know. DM me, let's chat. Maybe there's just something I'm missing, which is entirely possible. And then with the downright campy, I first had this in the bad bucket because it kind of is bad, but it's also kind of campy. The Shobijin are portrayed against a blue screen, which looks good, But there are moments where the humans reach down and pick them up, and in like some really quick shots, you see that they're clearly like Barbie dolls. And in those moments, I just had to face palm. I was like, oh my God, you are just picking up dolls. It's too silly. It's too campy. Borderline bad, but like I said, you have to laugh at it. So ultimately, my verdict, is it a classic? Is it kind of antiquated but stands the test of time? Is it just fun and historically significant but doesn't stand the test of time? Or is it not worth watching? Does like nothing about it stands the test of time? I am gonna give it a classic status. I think there are, the blackface is obviously egregiously dated. The doll effects are antiquated. They don't really hold up. But you only see them, honestly, in like a split second. So I'm making a bigger deal of it than it is. Everything else is true. This movie is a gorgeous palette for Ishiro Honda and Tsuburaya. Like, they are acting as if they are painters in front of a canvas. Some of the shots that Honda elicits is total imagination. It's imagination fuel. There's a great overlay crossfade with a starry night, and the Shobijin are in the stars, and Mothra's caterpillar is like swimming through the ocean. And I was like, this is freaking gorgeous. I loved it. And Tsuburaya's effects, they all hold up. So if you love kaiju movies, it is a classic. If you're new to the genre, I would probably still recommend a few others before you get to this one. But yeah, it's not a bad place to start at all. So that's what I got on Mothra, guys. And I can't thank you enough for bearing with me. Longer episode than usual, but I think this is going to be the new usual. Sort of the same kind of rundown. Co-hosts are coming. Until then, you got me. So be sure to check out the merchandise store, link in the bio. You can get an official Camp Kaiju t-shirt here. Queen of the Monsters. And follow us on Letterboxd and Instagram. Tell your friends about it if you have any who love, dig monster movies. And until next time, take care.